Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Martin Kemp, who's Emeritus Research Professor in the History of Art at Oxford University. Martin has published and broadcast extensively on Leonardo, Renaissance art, and the links between art and science. He's also the editor of the magisterial Oxford History of Western Art. When I met him at his home in Oxfordshire recently, it was to talk about his latest book, the memorably titled Christ to Coke, which takes Martin's writing in a new direction, going far beyond the confines of traditional art history to investigate what happens when particularly potent images are released into the wild, as it were, and become part of a wider visual culture. Christ to Coke examines the process by which image becomes icon, with the help of 11 leading examples, ranging from the figure of Christ to the Coke bottle, via the cross, the lion, the heart, the stars and stripes, the Mona Lisa, the double helix, and several others. Do these diverse images share common underlying characteristics? Do they achieve their status as icons in similar ways? What part does luck play? What happens to their meaning as their stock rises, and they get taken up in radically different contexts from that of their original creation? These are just some of the fascinating questions which Martin Kemp pursues in this book. But before we touch on any of those, I asked him to tell me what exactly constituted an icon.
Icon is a word that comes from image in Greece, and it's obviously attached in art historical terms to pictures with gold backgrounds and rather severe hieratic images of religious figures. But it's transferred into something which has extraordinary status. It's become a bit debased, I think, because, you talk about relatively passing pop people as icons and so on. But for me, an icon is an image of terrific and enduring fame.
And what you wanted to track and to investigate was the process by which an image turned into an icon.
Images start within functional contexts. You know, they're done by somebody to do a job at a particular time, a particular place, and a particular audience. And one of the fascinations of looking at these very famous images is not just how they were made, and they have to be remarkable in their making in almost every sense, but how they have got to where they are, and the strange paths, sometimes delayed paths, by which they got to their point of extraordinary interest. Mm.
They get out there into the wider visual cultural world, don't they? And things happen to them, some of which are deliberate, some of which are contingent.
In a sense, the images lose control of their own context, so that something like Che, for instance, the Che Guevara, here is a communist revolutionary, a totalitarian who believes in dictatorship of the proletariat, who's become a romantic image for people who certainly wouldn't espouse that. And that's so with all of them to a degree. They've got detached from meaning. E equals mc squared, the famous Einstein quotation, has become attached to the atomic bomb. And Einstein certainly wasn't one of the progenitors of the atomic bomb as a pacifist.
Tell me then, how did you select your list of 11 images whose stories you tell in this book? That must have been quite a tough challenge.
I started with Mona Lisa. I've been happy to leave her or it out, but it's unavoidable. And DNA, which I'd written about for the 50th anniversary of the publication, I'd written about for Nature, where the original publication occurred. So they picked themselves. I then thought, why not do a book on icons? I couldn't quite think nobody had done it. Anyway, nobody had. And I drew up lists, basically just long lists without any particular shape or purpose behind them other than lists. And I talked to people. I said, what are your iconic images? I then thought, how do you organize this? There's no point in discussing large numbers of images in a kind of amorphous way. So at a certain point, they crystallize around types. There were types which were kind of abstract graphic symbols, like the cross, which also, of course, has lots of figurative aspects to it. There's an animal like the lion. So it dropped down into types. A photograph, which is Kim Fook running down the road napalmed. Two from science, as it seemed to me that in 20th century that science had produced major iconic images, which hadn't so much happened with science before. So it crystallized around 11 types. I'm not saying there are any 11 types or these are ideal, but it also helped because in each type you could say, well, my chosen image stands a decent chance of being the most well-known.
Now, you start off with the image of Christ. Does this mean that the ancient world, the classical world, didn't produce any icons of real staying power?
I've begun with Christ because he is, as it were, what the zoologists would call a type specimen. That is the image that became called an icon, along with the Virgin, and there are obviously icons of saints as well. So it seemed to be a point to start, but the book does move back and forth, and one of the lions is a lion-headed Egyptian goddess. So we get back to Egypt, we get back to some date in China. The actual example I'm showing is 18th century, but the book is not chronological as such. So it's not going from Christ in some sort of chronological step-by-step way.
It would be fair to say that images of Christ got off to a rather faltering start, wouldn't it? How did the image of Christ that is familiar to us today begin to take shape?
At first, there was a prescription on images of Christ, which came really from Judaic religion, the ban on graven images. And it's very late. It's sort of 3rd, 4th century. It's slightly unclear. And initially, the prime look was a youngish Christ, who was shown as a shepherd of his people and so on. And it was only really when Christian religion under Constantine became the official religion of a state, the state militant, so it actually allied itself rather than as a dissident group to the mainstream state, that you got the ruler image. And the ruler image tends to be figure looking at you as he is commanding you, and they're almost all men at this time, with a beard, looking venerable and authoritative. So the Christ one comes almost as a kind of Jupiter-like image or a stock image of a king. But it's very late, you know. If you take 3-4 centuries, I mean, that's a long time afterwards in our terms. It's a bit like saying we don't have any images of Elvis Presley until 4 centuries' time, which is, and it would not be regarded as reliable.
And you make the point, I think, that these rather austere, stylized medieval images, which bear the sort of traits of the Orthodox iconography, actually seem to speak to believers in a way that the more sort of rounded human Renaissance Christs don't. What do you think is operating there?
It's one of the surprising things to ourselves, who are used to thinking that portraits are naturalistic things, is that the images made, but not made by hand, made by implication by Christ, are archaic. They're not fully naturalistic, and yet they have enormous power. And it's clear that there is something in those sorts of images. Their simplicity, directness, uncomplicated memorability that has a major impact. And also they look old. If you have one of these images and you've got a bit of Greek on it, for instance, then it exudes an air of ancient authority. And almost all the religious images that work serious miracles, they're not like Raphael. They're not sort of nice, sweet, naturalistic images. They tend to be the ones that have this air of ancient authority. So it's quite surprising if you think about it logically, but logic doesn't apply in these situations.
And talking about the backstory, that seems to be quite a common phenomenon, that many of your images share. This story of their origins becomes part of the sort of mythos and the power of the image.
The iconic images both generate and attract legends at a remarkable pace. You know, you'd think there would be more legends in old image, but it's almost not time dependent, that once you get something like the Coke bottle becoming very famous, it almost needs legends. And if you've got a straightforward explanation, once an image becomes very famous, the straightforward one won't do. We basically know who Mona Lisa was. She was Lisa Gherardini. fairly unexceptionable upper bourgeois woman who gave birth to five children, was greatly beloved by her husband, as some documents show. So it's a routine origin, in a way, for an extraordinary object. But, of course, that won't do once you've got as famous as the Mona Lisa. The straightforward facts simply won't suffice.
One of the things you wanted to do in this book was to write in a more personal style. And so there are little glimpses of autobiography which come into it. And one of the most arresting for me was when you describe the experience of actually seeing the Mona Lisa, as it were, stripped of all the protective layers of bulletproof, whatever it is, perspex or glass. Tell me what that experience was like. When did it happen and how did it happen and what was it like?
I felt with this book, where the images are living today, they're not historical images in some distance, they're still vibrant today, that sense of giving their immediacy was important. And in the case of the Mona Lisa, that was both exciting and kind of terrifying in a way, because you've got this amazing image which I'd written about, and I've seen it obviously like everybody else in the Louvre. I was there in a spring morning, and the Mona Lisa is taken out every year for annual inspection. It's measured for warping, it's looked, checked for condition, and checked, I suppose, to see it's still the real thing and hasn't been replaced, but that's hardly likely. But I knew Pierre Rosenberg, who's the director of the Louvre, a wonderfully cultivated urbane man, and I said to him, look, at some point I'd love to see this out of its frame. It came out of its bulletproof case. It was laid down on its back on a table in its frame, then face down and removed, and it came out. And you think, well, this could be a bit dodgy, because what if it doesn't do anything? I needn't have been worried, because it's just sensational. It's one of those works which reacts to the viewer and to the light. So it's, in a way, constantly in flux. This sounds a bit like Sood's Corner, but it's the only way of describing it. Rembrandt can do that. A few Velasquez can do that. But they can use transparent pigments, opaque pigments, set colour against colour, leave form both described and elusive, so that your act of viewing, both as the light changes and even under steady light, is a dynamic process. And it was simply spine-tingling.
How much do you think accidents and contingency, again, sticking with the Mona Lisa, come into the catapulting of an image into the status of icon? Because often it seems in the stories there is some sort of something almost accidental, or someone just being at the right place at the right time, or maybe a picture being acquired by someone and being part of a collection, or the story that accrues. So how do you distinguish between the sort of intrinsic aspects of the image and this sort of contingent characteristic which sometimes accrues?
I would say the intrinsic parts of the image, though it's always difficult to talk about that because each viewer has a slightly different intrinsic image, but let's take there's something stable at the centre of that, and the accidents, the contingencies, are both essential. The bits in the story play a crucial role. The theft of the Mona Lisa from the Louvre by Vincenzo Perugia, who was helping to reglaze some of the Louvre pictures. He wasn't a house painter, as sometimes stated. All these things get sort of, that's an example, where things get established which are not true. It was said he stored it under a stove. It was actually in a cupboard in his rather dingy apartment. But that story of the theft and the cues seeing the space on the wall is all part of it. And it all ratchets up the interest and the fame of the object. But there must be something to work with. If it wasn't sticking, it had got to a point, not entirely unaided, but it had got to the point where it was a famous picture. So there's always a dialogue between the object and its own power and these extraordinary stories. But you need the stories.
And when we get to Che Guevara, we have a kind of loop back to Christ, don't we? And we have a sort of almost a two-way traffic, really, of artists and image makers playing up at these resemblances.
Che and Christ, the image sort of fuses, and it's partly that Che himself cultivated this image. He after all came up in a Catholic culture, and this young man with a beard, he was blessed with good looks. When Korda took the photograph at the rally to lambast America after the explosion in Havana Harbor, which was attributed, I think probably rightly, to the Americans, he was wearing the beret. Korda photographed him from below, so the beret becomes a kind of halo. And there is sufficient of Christ in that, that when this image is reduced to a poster image, posterized as they say, that's to say reduced to very simple outlines and so on, it actually worked incredibly like the icons of Christ. And one of the characteristics of a number of the iconic images is that they reduce very well. You can take out masses of detail, take out lots of information, and you can still say, ah, that's Christ, ah, that's Che, or ah, that's the Mona Lisa. Even if, like Warhol, you actually reduce Mona Lisa to almost nothing.
I was thinking, really, all your images retain some power, don't they? I was thinking, even the Coke bottle, I mean, it's something which the Coca-Cola Corporation protectively guards. So they've all got some kind of worth and power inherent in them, as we perceive it.
Every one of the images, and I'm not saying the 11 images I've chosen are absolutely the most famous one, but they all undoubtedly have power. They all carry emotional baggage, collectively and individually, of an extraordinary kind. And Coke, the bottle, was trademarked in 1961, so not just the logo, but the bottle, which of course gives us quite a lot of fun when we're trying to get permission to illustrate Coke bottles and Coke logos in the chapter, but that's all part of the story.
Martin, I finally want to talk about science. The final two chapters in your book concern science, in one case the double helix of DNA, and the other Einstein's E equals MC squared. Now, on the face of it, it would seem that 20th century science is a domain really too recondite and abstract and difficult to generate images, and yet it has.
These images are exceptional. I think we are very much in the 20th century, and the 19th century to a degree, a society aware of the bigness of science. We can get men on the moon, we can explode atomic bombs, we can see into minute parts of the atom and see what goes on. Yet iconic images are difficult. Complex physical equations are not going to do the job. We probably know what atomic collisions look like. We know what the mushroom cloud looks like. That probably is iconic, but that is a war image, perhaps, rather than a scientific image. So these are unusual, and they have a basic simplicity, a simplicity which doesn't equate to people knowing what they mean. E equals MC squared, indeed, wasn't, and this was a great surprise to me, wasn't coined, as far as I can tell, by Einstein himself. It's a very limited case of the mass-energy formula, but they have that ringing simplicity. The double helix is recognizable. It can be reduced to schematics, and it's on jewelry and all sorts of things. So they are, in terms of 20th century science, rather unusual. And equally important scientific things, Schrödinger's equation, for instance, which appears on his gravestone, I doubt whether most people in science know that, let alone in a more general audience. So they are unusual, but then they do a terrifically potent job. You're looking for images which represent the wonder of 20th century science, of understanding, in one case, the secret of life. And that's not my term, that's what Crick was saying when he was in the pub, saying, "We got the secret of life." And on the other hand, represent the puzzling mysteries of energy and mass in the universe, which in one side are reflected in the bomb, and on the other side represented by distances and behaviours which are beyond most people's mental grasp, including mine, I have to say.
Martin Kemp. Christ to Coke, How Image Becomes Icon, is published by Oxford University Press and is out this October in hardback. You can find out more about Christ to Coke, as well as several million other titles, by visiting blackwell.co.uk. You'll also find a podcast archive there with over 150 author interviews by clicking the podcast tab on the home page. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.